G'day, folks. Talk to Joe Williams, a proud Wiradjuri man that runs The Enemy Within, suicide prevention and wellbeing education. Talking about what he's gone through with his own trauma and his career in the NRL with the South Sydney Rabbitohs, which led on to professional boxing and what he's currently doing now, running these awesome workshops around the country and even tapping into overseas. Because suicide is in every community. And it's okay to talk about it. It's important to speak up. Men, women, everybody. You're doing solid work out there, brother, in the community. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. So if you want to become a part of the squad, be a patron, check out the link below. That'd be great. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permanville Australia, the greatest electrical chairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Jay Williams, thanks for coming down on the Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs podcast and just having a yarn about the important work you're doing through the nation and just who you are, brother. So really appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. It's always good to connect with different mob right throughout the place. You know, whether it's I'm a big believer in connection. You know, connecting obviously face to face would have been a great deal better, but we're confronted with challenging times at the moment, mate. So you know, connection, however we do it, with technology these days and different ways that we can connect on phones, whether it be in person, however we do it. It's just about connecting with people, mate, having conversations.
That's it. So where's your mob from?
I'm a Wiradjuri Wagaloo man. So Wiradjuri being out, you know, the big nation in New South Wales. And Wagaloo is a tiny little nation at the base of the mountains, you know, over near it's so small that you can't even see it on that map behind you. You know, it's over near a little place called Tumut, so in between Ngunnawal and Wiradjuri, and Ngamri, all that sort of area. But you know, it's a tiny little place near Tumut. My old man was born up in our family was one of the original families back at a place called Brungle, which was one of the Aboriginal missions in early settlement days. So I'm over that way, and my mum's mob's from Orange, so we're Wiradjuri way, but we all sort of grew up. I grew up in Cowra with my sisters and brother.
That's just north of Cowra, yeah, Orange, not too far away.
I think more northwest maybe. Towards Dubbo-ish way. You know, sort of out that way, Orange, Bathurst, all those sort of areas, you know.
And that's where you are today, yeah, out Dubbo. Yeah.
We're in Dubbo, yeah. So, mate, the boss is a Dubbo girl, and she goes wherever she says to go. You know, I'm not silly in that regard. If she's the boss, she makes the calls, and I just turn up where I got to.
Yeah, staying strong on those Wiradjuri ties, that's for sure. And as said before, that brown area on the map there, one of the biggest mobs in the nation, like the old Wiradjuri mob. So there's a fair few of yous, like, you know, on country and around Australia, that's for sure.
I always stir different communities wherever I go, mate, about everyone. We're the biggest nation because everyone wants to be like us. Everyone wants to come in there and hang out with us. So I always say we're the biggest nation, but we're also the best looking, best dancers, and best whichever one you want to call it. So
settle down.
Causes some laughs and some jeers in the crowd, mate, when I get that one.
Now you got to jam up, eh? So COVID, it's hit everybody hard, real hard, like throughout the nation, like throughout the world. But just with yourself and with work and everything else going on, and now you've got this bloody Delta strain that's ripping through the East Coast like a wildfire, and especially through Sydney and spreading out. And just how has that affected yourself, brother, and general life?
It's been a challenge for me. It's been a challenge for me as in business-wise, completely, you know, to the floor as far as What I do, so a lot of what I do is out in community. So, you know, communities aren't confident with people coming in now, and I get that 100%. I get it. You know, 2020 was sort of, I was stuck at home all year. And then this year, they were starting to get some confidence out there to start doing some work around the place again. But now it's now we're sort of in the grip of it once more. So, you know, I took last year and this year as well a real opportunity to do some work on myself. You know, I talk about doing the work all the time, doing the inner work and starting to understand who we are as people. And you know, last year I went deep into, you know, having some conversations, but also understanding why I am the way I am.
And that's always good, reflecting on yourself. Like, it's always good to, yeah, go 100 miles steaming ahead doing what you're doing, but just having that self-reflection and seeing where you are and, you know, because there's always room for improvement for everyone, hey?
Well, there is, but also, you know, second to that is that whilst there's room for improvement, we're going to understand why we are the way we are as well. And what a lot of people don't understand is that we're all a product of the first 1,000 days of our lives, they say, you know, and a lot of why we are is because we've been seen and conditioned and learnt everything the way we are now. So, you know, it's important to, we get triggered about different things. We behave different ways. We speak in different ways. We react in different ways. We're going to understand why. When you understand why, that's when you can start to, you know, make some adjustments if it's not quite right. So it's important to be able to do that work.
Yeah, very much so. And talking about the hows and the whys and the whos and talking about who's, like who you are. And just before you had that light bulb moment with Enemy Within to start that organization and just the building blocks of that, like the foundation of who you are, like where and who is Joe Williams before that all started out with Enemy Within?
I was a sports player. You know, I was someone who never, ever, ever thought that I'd end up doing what I'm doing now. You know, we talk about paths in life, and I had a path of being a rugby league player, and then I had a path of being a boxer. And I think my life's purpose, they say the two most important days of your life are the day you're born and then the day you find out why you're born. I think the day you find out why you're born, you find out your life's purpose. And my purpose, I was put onto this path to help other people. It's a path that's still continuing. It's a path that I'm still learning and growing on as an individual. But for a long time, I was a sports person and a sports person who struggled behind the closed doors with suicidal ideation. I had done for a lot of years. You know, and there was, you know.
So you had that as a young fella, yeah?
Since I was about the age of 13.
Yeah. You
know, right. The first time I can recall that. You know, a dialogue inside my head that talked to me and told me that I was no good, that I was worthless, that I don't deserve to be alive, and carried that all my life throughout my footy career, throughout my boxing career, everything. And it wasn't until, you know, I was taken to the path of a suicide attempt and tried with the power of my two hands to not be sitting here talking to you today, and something bigger than me kept me here. You know, it's now, again, it was in those moments I found out why I was born. You know, and that put me on the trajectory of the path of helping other people. The more I started to talk to other people and normalize what it is that we go through internally, help people to understand what it is we go through internally, do we start to get some real paths to wellness. It's about, you know, understanding that and helping others to achieve that. And helping others to achieve that is what helps me the most.
And with the normalization of that, because it's always, because you see the stigma with it, and it's hard with men, you know, whether it's Aboriginal First Nations people, Torres Strait Islanders, or people in general. And, you know, when you're going through like a pressure cooker system of professional sports and the NRL, so what was it feeling like when you were within that system and feeling that way? Was it just a bit of shame or just bit at that point of your life, like not being able to speak out?
I thought that everyone went through it. I thought that everyone had this inside their head. And then when, you know, you start to do some work on it and you start to understand, and many, many years after, like, not everyone has these thoughts in their head every day. whilst they're just trying to get up and have a good day. You know, so it was about once I identified what it was, and it took me a long time to identify that. Don't worry. Like, it was down the path of alcohol and drug addiction, which I got clean from. And now, thankfully, to be, you know, 16 years sober and
good on
you. You know, many years also from, you know, clean from drugs as well. But I realized that I was band-aiding what was going on in my head through substance. But then I got clean. I took the substance away and the noise got turned up. And I was like, wow, I've got to really deal with this. And then, you know, boxing helped me to deal with that too, because boxing wasn't just about punching other people in the face. Boxing for me was about working on myself internally. It was about me, you know, working hard to the bell. It was about me, you know, not giving up, you know. So it's been a journey. It really has. But then, you know, it took me to the grips of a suicide attempt. So, and then, you know, psych facility stays and, you know, mental health wards and everything like that, you know. So it's all about learning and this path that we have. Unfortunately, it can have some really, really tough and struggling times. But it's in those tough times, I believe, that we're going to get closer to what's going on. Instead of running away from it and trying to band-aid it, we're going to get a little bit closer to it and start to find out why we are the way we are.
And that's it. You've got that lived experience where you've gone through that and come, you know, very close when you're talking about an attempted suicide attempt, and that could have, you know, that stuff can go either way. And
as I mentioned, you know, super lucky and super thankful that I'm still here. You know, if I had it my way in those times, I wouldn't be here. But obviously there's something out there that's bigger than me that controls that stuff that kept me here. So, you know, I've got a second chance now. I've got to take every step and make every post a winner.
Yeah, 100%. And going back to, before we jump into Enemy Within, and going back to professional sports and just the Aboriginality and what it comes with putting on a Rabbitohs jersey, just talk us through that process and just pulling on that jersey and what that felt to run out on the field and represent that team.
I think, going back, and I can't remember much about my actual first grade debut, because, you know, I talk the conversation that I speak about now is about head trauma and concussions and so forth as well, and the impacts of that has on our mental health. But when we look at my first grade debut, I had a concussion in the first 10 minutes of the game. So I don't remember a great deal of the game. I've never even seen it again. The game on tape or anything.
And back then, you probably would have played that whole game with
it. I played the whole game. Yeah, I wasn't out cold, but I was definitely, I was stung, you know, and I don't remember the game. So, you know, I do remember that day, and everything that could have went wrong. You know, I took the wrong turn to go to Shark Park, which took me onto the M5, which I was caught in peak hour traffic, which now made me late. I got to the game when the team was going in from the warm-up. You're supposed to be the game before two hours before, so you can warm up with the team and all that. Mate, I got to the game when the team was finishing the warm-up. So it took me the first 10 minutes to bloody warm up onto the field, but, you know, jump a presentation to me, I'll be in, you know, presented my jersey to me and all that sort of stuff. It was special times, but yeah, everything that could have went wrong that day. I got a knock in the head, we got beat, and, you know, it wasn't a great day. But the next weekend we actually beat the Storm, which for South was big back then because we didn't have a lot of wins.
Yeah. But, you know, the main thing is you're getting in and having a crack. So, you know, you put a few years in and – but, mate, you retired pretty early. So when you're talking about, you know, the retirement, like with footy and whatnot, so was it just looking at, hey, I want a different challenge and throw on the boxing gloves and just see where that can take me? Because did you have a little bit of a taste of it before, like whilst you're playing league, and just thought this is going to be my new path now and see where this takes me? Or
what it was, you know, I'd been someone who grew up in boxing gyms because the old man was an amateur boxer, and if there was Friday night fights and Friday night footy, I watched the fights 10 times out of 10, you know. I was a kid that always loved boxing. To this day, I love boxing. But it was when I finally walked away from rugby league, it was, I'd had enough. I'd had enough, blatantly honest. Like, I'd lost all interest in the game, and it was the only thing I had in common with my teammates was playing footy and going out and partying. Now, I was also on that path of sobriety, so I wasn't going out and partying anymore.
Yeah.
And I just lost interest in everything that I was doing. And, you know, I started doing some work in the off-season with Johnny Lewis, the great boxing trainer.
Yep.
And, you know, I started moving around a little bit and hit the bag. And the more I hit the bag, the more I realized that it was doing good for me, like mentally and emotionally. Like, I was obviously working fairly hard and, as a boxer, and you know, I was having a few spars and so forth. And he said, mate, do you want to fight? You hold your hands up all right. Do you want to have a go at it?
Right.
Well, might as well. But for me, like, when I first went to boxing, people sort of half laughed at me because I wasn't a real aggressive footy player. And even as a boxer, I wasn't an aggressive fighter. Like, I love the art form of boxing, of hit and not get hit, you know. So I didn't fit particularly the boxing
That stereotype mold sort of thing.
I was a very placid sort of person and for what I thought was boxers, but you know, the more boxing gyms you go into and the more you interact with boxers, you realise that boxers are some of the most humble people you could ever meet. Even the outlandish and the ones who are outspoken, they too are super humble when you get them by themselves.
Yeah, you'll see them turn it on when they have to, and, you know, because that's going to be pumping up the fight and whatever else. And obviously if it's a high level and you got pay-per-views and everything involved. But, yeah, I agree with you there 100%. And what's like, because you've been in – you know, both camps there when you're looking at boxing and league, like team sports to individualize. So what, how did it feel with the difference between like the physical nature of it, how the intensity of it, and mentally, like where that would sort of put you in your place and how you dealt with it?
I'll give you an indication. I played footy at 82 kilo.
And
I boxed at 63.
Really?
Right. So,
mate, you dropped some... 20 kilos
difference, right? And that's just through hard work and obviously not lifting weights and stuff anymore when you're boxing and you know, when you're boxing, you're doing different types of training, you're long, running long, you know, kilometers on the road and things like that. So it's, you had to transform the body. So pretty much I went from 82 kilo in my last rugby league game to 69 kilo for my first fight.
Jeez.
And then I ended up fighting it. I fought my second fight at 66, and then majority of my fights then 63. I even made 61 kilo once. Nelly bloody killed me making that weight. But just a different type of training, different, you know. So the comparison of what your attitude's going to be like as a boxer compared to, you know, eating as much as you can to be big and bulky as a footy player, to hardly eating anything as a boxer.
And how was that mental aspect for you? You know, what grind that it takes when you're going into weight cutting, when you know, you're depriving yourself of water, especially if you're leading up to weigh-ins and you got to really make that weight. Obviously, you know, they can, if the other fighter doesn't want to have a go, then they can, you know, cut the fight altogether. So how, like, mentally, do you think that put you... What stratosphere did that push you towards, mate, when you were...
I think those type of weight cuts and those type of times in my boxing career, I wrote about it in my book, how in between each fight, whether you lose a fight and you've got to go and work on things for the next 2 or 3 months till you have another fight, and you've got to work on it every day. And you've got that little voice in your head telling you you're not good enough, and you've got that little voice in your head telling you to work harder, and, you know, questioning why you got beaten, and, you know, and then the discipline of not having a bottle of soft drink in comparison to having chips, you know. So it's that mental discipline, that that I needed as a boxer. They're the things I wrote about in my book as far as building the resilience to help me mentally and emotionally now. Mm. So I learned that in those moments that you just got to stay present in what you're doing and don't think long-term, just think now.
Yeah, and thinking about now, so you jump through the ropes, like building up nerves. Like, what's the nerves leading up to compared to jumping into a ring compared to hitting the footy field? Like,
because you footy.
Yeah,
you're in still footy, mate, you just different. Well, in footy, you've done it since you're a kid. You know, yeah, yeah. In footy, you strap your boots on like you do every other weekend. Mm, mm. Boxing, you're preparing for 2 to 3 months for one fight, and you're working out, you're working hard every single day. You know, two times a day, with a plan to execute. And if you don't execute that plan, then you could be hit and knocked out in an instant, you know? So it's the mental capacity around that, again, which I say that boxing was one of the things that changed my life and helped me to fight back mentally and emotionally because it taught me how to be mentally strong. As I said, you can just flick your boots on and go, I could put my boots on now, overweight and old, and go and play a game of footy now, right? Yeah, yeah. Not at a hugely high level, but I could go and play 80 minutes, no worries. I wouldn't be able to get through two rounds now as a boxer.
It's totally different, the cardio, yeah?
The cardio, the mental ability, everything. You know, your mind starts to tell yourself that you don't want to be in there, but then, you know, that pride makes you grit down in your mouth guard to think that you can be in there, you know? So it's they're two different sports, and as I said, I've played both significant parts of my journey.
Mate, I've seen some of the belts there. I've seen them in some of the pics from social media and whatnot, seen a few boats, a few belts floating around. So what was it, WBA, or what associations were they with?
Now, I was lucky enough to win WBF, okay. The World Boxing Foundation. I won a few different titles with them. I won the world title with them twice as well, and the WBC Asia title as well. So, you know, the WBF is probably one of the smaller, you know, a lot smaller sanctioning bodies. But at the end of the day, it's not about the belts for me or the prestige of it. It's the fact that I got myself out of bed every single morning during some really, really tough times to get out there and continue to put one foot after another when I didn't want to. You know, and they are rewards. And I think for me, recognition that I could do it. And they're a reminder, a constant reminder that when I'm having a tough time, I look at those things and say, you know what? Those aren't for me anymore. They're for my kids to be proud of. That I can, you know, have on the wall and they can be proud of. And I can see as a testament to some times that I've got through that are extremely tough.
100%, all the hard work. Enemy within. What does that mean to you?
Well, it's exactly what it is, right? You know, you look at rugby league. I come up against and played against some fantastic players on the rugby league field, and then I come up against some guys in the boxing ring that wanted to punch my head off. But I can honestly say that nothing ever compares to the enemy I fight inside my head every single day. And a lot of people will resonate with that because mentally, some things can be really challenging. So, you know, the name, the enemy within, exactly what it is. Mm. You know, it's the enemy within our own mind, and it's about not overcoming, but learning to manage it, learning to walk side by side with it, hand in hand some days, and say, you know what, we don't need to fight against each other. We can walk together.
Well said. Yeah, especially when it's about hand in hand, just knowing how to manage. You know, it's hard to overcome, but if you can, you know, manage it and move forward, that's the main thing. And, you know, growing up in community and seeing across the landscape with Aboriginal communities that are going through the struggle, like, and you're looking at what you've gone through with your own struggles, and you were pretty young, brother, like when you're talking about 13. So what have you seen, or what did you see, like when you're leading up to what you wanted to do within community and with enemy within, what could you see within community that made you want to get out and yarn to people?
I just saw the struggle. You know, it was was one of those things that when I first started speaking about it, I think it normalized that someone who's got some profile in a smaller community, if he goes through it, I can go through it as well, you know? So it normalized the conversation. And then, you know, we know about the, you know, the horrific rates that we have, challenging rates in our community. So,
That's right.
You know, it's about going out and helping give a voice to the silenced, you know, in a lot of times. And it's about, you know, helping them through tough times.
Suicide, like, it's a delicate topic when it comes to, you know, First Nations mob or Australians in general, and whether that's a person that's going through it, leading up to it, or whether that's the person from the outside trying to understand. And like myself, like, I've known people over the years that have carried through with the act, and it's been hard. And for myself, trying to understand it, and when, especially when you're looking at someone that, when you're just looking at a picture and they look happy and it's a happy family, and then the next minute they're gone, and it's trying to understand what that person's going through. But you never know what's going on behind closed doors, or I should say behind closed minds, when that person's got that internal struggle. They might look like, you know, everything's working out for the person, for them on the outside, but internally there's that struggle, and then the next thing you know, they're gone. And it's, as an outsider, me trying to look out and saying, you know, how could have I helped, or what could have I done? And it's hard for a lot of people that, you know, just trying to understand suicide in general.
I think it's a tough thing to understand.
Mm.
You know, like, even people who go through it, we don't understand it. We don't understand why. We know logically that everything we need to do is to reach out to people. Everything we need to do is to exercise. Everything we need to do is to, you know, is to talk to people who can understand or can get us help. But the mind doesn't let us do it. So it's like, you know, a real disconnect between who we actually are at times. And then you can imagine that the repercussions then it has, or the flow-on effect that it has to the people around us. We're super disconnected. We're disconnected from ourselves. We're going to be even more disconnected from the community.
Mm.
And our family. So a lot of what I tell people is to try not to understand it. What we need to do is just to look at behaviours of people, look at behaviours of people, and just don't ignore any little sign. If someone's acting differently or acting odd or not acting like themselves, let's jump on that, you know, and ask them, you know, what's up? Is everything okay? Is there anything I can do? You know, what can I do to help? You know, they're just the tough but important questions that we need to ask each other.
Yeah, 100%. And when you're looking at this, the subheadings of enemy within, when you're talking about suicide prevention and well-being education. So when you're looking at preventative measures and topping up well-being and education, what's the first steps when you're going into preventative measures and looking at that? Because it's hard for some people to, whether that's a person that's going through it or whether that's an outsider that's knows someone that's going through the struggle. So what's baseline where you can jump into that from either side of the fence?
Yeah, I think just keeping people safe. Just keeping people safe, you know, and isolation is the first key, you know. But again, like, isolation may not be a sign of danger for some people, because I'm someone who isolates all the time. You know, I pull myself away from people because I'm very much an introvert naturally, but have to be an extrovert because of the work I do. Right. So I like to be alone, but the people around me, the people close to me, recognize with me when I'm not well. They ask me, is everything okay? You know, they ask me when I'm, you know, everyone's starting to tread on eggshells around the house and I'm kicking stones everywhere. You know, right. They ask me, they're going to have the important questions. Because at the end of the day, like, sometimes we don't get to ask the questions and then we kick ourselves because we didn't.
100%.
Right. We just need to pay attention to behaviours and make sure that we're helping each other.
That's right. And talking about paying attention to behaviours, mate, so when you're looking at urban, rural and remote, because suicide, it doesn't matter where you are on the globe, but you know, reactions are different and the way that people operate are different when you're looking at urban, rural, remote. But what do you see with differences when you're going into different communities?
You know, and I speak from a range of communities, from communities who are very well off, you know, financially, and then there's communities that struggle to fight for a feed every night, you know. So there's many aspects to what I see on the ground, but there's one common theme of hurt, you know, and what it comes from and the underlying factors of what it is. We look at, you know, what's happening with us mentally and emotionally, and what's happening with us mentally and emotionally now is a reflection from something that we've been through. So what we have to do is have a look at some of the things that we've been through, go through, and we have to be very mindful of the behaviors that we speak in front of young people, the, you know, the behaviors and actions that we do in front of young people. Because, you know, again, as adults, we're all a reflection of things that we've seen and been conditioned to in the early years of our lives.
Conditioning. So when you're looking at intergenerational trauma, like to do with a lot of mob around the country, so do you think that takes a lot of effect in how a lot of mob, you know, feel and think, and when it's got to do with what mob have gone through and how emotions are being handed down through the generations?
Yeah, I think, you know, what we're going to have a look at, there's obviously, you know, there's obviously genetic traits and features that do that. But the one common thing that's handed down throughout the generations is our behaviours, right? Now, it's the littlest of things, the way that we raise our voice, the way that, you know, the normalized behaviors of kids getting a beer for dad out of the fridge, you know, those sort of normalized behaviors are the things that we need to, you know, to start to have a look at as adults and who we are now, because, you know, no one is exempt from, you know, different challenges that we have. And when we're looking at the things that have been handed down generationally, generational struggle has been handed down to us, you know, like it's, and it's very much, you know, the implications or the reflections of that, or even the symptoms of that, things like alcohol abuse and violence and, you know, some of the different behaviours that we speak in communities. You know, behavior is language. So we're going to have a look at what's the language we're speaking in our communities, because how we act and model to our kids is exactly how they're going to act and model to their kids. We're going to draw a line in the sand and not do it anymore.
100%. It's setting the tone. And like you said, it's, you know, getting that language throughout. And it's not always easy when you're looking like with a lot of mob that are on country and then, you know, whether that it's pretty isolated and people like, oh, why don't you just move away and just, you know, go to an urban setting or whatnot. And it's, you know, a lot of people aren't like that. They want to stay on country. It's who they are, where they belong. And a lot of people don't get that. Like in my
Yeah, and they don't. Yeah. They don't. I think, you know, and I talk a lot about what is mental health to our communities. And mental health isn't particularly what's going on in our mind for our communities. It's a lot of who we are spiritually as people as well, and where we live and the impact of how we live can be a huge factor in that. So, you know, I always talk about a conversation I had with an elder out this way, a great man, Uncle Paul Gordon. And he said to me one evening, sitting around the fire with him, he said, "You're not mentally ill. I'll challenge what anyone says to you. I don't think you're mentally ill." And I was like, what do you mean by this? You know, like, this is something I've been told for 10 years. You're not mentally ill, you're spiritually ill. When you heal your spirit, that's when you get well. And it clicked, you know, and he said, you can't heal your spirit inside four walls.
That would have felt powerful, eh?
Oh, you got to get out on country and you got to sit around fires, you got to listen to old people and you got to learn the stories. Right, because what people don't understand is that all of our old stories, all of our dreaming stories right throughout the country, no matter where you are, all of our dreaming stories had lessons of well-being.
100%.
Helping each other, looking after each other, respecting the land, sharing with each other. Like, the answer to getting well for our country, no matter who you are, black, blue, green, I don't care, is in our stories. That's all of those values and all of those lessons in all of our stories is about helping each other get well.
That's it. Helping each other, whether that's physically, mentally, for yourself or the mob in the community, which is very important. And the thing is, you know, and I get sick of this and just the overrepresentation of mob in jail and just the system not really taken on board, like the mental health, the disability, the intergenerational trauma with mob that are in jail. When, you know, I've known some mob where they've been 10 years locked up, indefinite detention, without a charge, you know, on remand. And it's the system really not taking note of this person, of the mental health and the disability and all other factors that come in. And where there needs to be more systems put in place, because you look at the suicide rates that do drive people when they're locked up, whether they're inside, right, whether that takes place, or you've got mob that have been locked up for 10 years, institutionalized, come out, don't know how to deal with life, and where they end up going down the suicide route.
It's like they're still chained in the mind. Mm. You know, and it's about trying to help people, not only to help the individual understand, but help the wider community understand the impacts of that. You know, I would argue that a huge percentage of people that are incarcerated are in there for trauma-related illnesses, like trauma-related incidents as well. You know, like we get in there and there's a lot of the times alcohol and violence involved. Mm. Alcohol is a reflection of trauma. Violence is a reflection of trauma. You know, again, don't look at what the behavior is, look at why the behavior is. When we start to understand the why, that's when we're going to start to get some ground with people.
Yeah, and you're not seeing a lot of, you know, good rehabilitation processes yet. There are a lot of good ones on the outside, but I'm talking about when it's the whole transitional period. If you're looking at mob that are in jail, they're not getting the right means.
I don't care what anyone says, but in jail is not a rehabilitation center.
100%. No.
No way. They're putting people who are mentally, spiritually, and traumatically ill into a place that's just going to exacerbate the behaviours, right? What we need to do is stop locking people up and start finding out why they're having their behaviours, start to understand and address the behaviours, right? Because all we're doing is we put someone in prison for 20 years, they go in there for trauma-related behavioural incidents. That trauma is still there after 20 years. If you haven't done the work on it, you come out, you go back to exactly the same behaviours.
And like you said, you know, it exacerbates, it adds fuel, it keeps pushing that. If you don't end up getting rehabilitation processes in place, it's just systemic cycles with recidivism and it's just going to be ongoing. And when we're looking at rehabilitation, but what I want to jump into, so we're looking at where rehabilitation processes aren't in place and we're talking about jails and just talking about the impact that can have. And so I hope the wider community can realize to some degree, have a bit of empathy, because we're looking at the nation now being locked up.
That's the thing. Like you look at people are really uncomfortable with these lockdowns. Mm. I start to question why we're uncomfortable. Is it because we don't like being locked down? Is it because we don't like being controlled? Is it because we don't like sitting in the silence of our own head?
Mm.
Now think of people who are incarcerated.
22 hours a day, locked up in a concrete cell, no bigger than a toilet cubicle, and then let out for 2 hours in the yard to get a little bit of vitamin D, maybe, you know?
You know, like it's, we got to have a look at, you know, different, that system's not working. You know, if we've got the recidivism of people that's, it's a revolving door, then it's not working, you know, because we should be rehabilitating people so they don't want to go back into prison. And as it sits, the stats will probably show you that, you know, it's not the case.
That's right. And we're seeing this all in real time where people are getting fed up. I'm just talking about lockdown, whether that's people in jails or, you know, it's different, but with people that are obviously free out in the society, but people not feeling free at the moment because obviously with the lockdowns, but you're seeing this spread out with social media and where people are elevating that platform through different mediums, or where these protests now are rolling out onto the streets. So you can feel and see the frustrations of it all. So
yeah, that's something it is. It's, you know, obviously with the, you know, with people, you know, spilling out on the streets, the inconsistencies of what they're seeing and hearing on TV, the different inconsistencies with health advices and so forth as well. You know, people are frustrated. I think people are frustrated as a reflection of not being able to work and being locked in their own doors, and which is also keeping us trapped in their own heads.
That's right. And, mate, talking about people feeling trapped, so we're going over to, because I looked into a bit of your work that you done when you went over to the States, and I just wanted to touch on, like, the Indian mobs over in the States, and, you know, you went over there and protesting and doing some important work, but is there a lot of similarities between Indian and Americans and mob over
there? The Native American mob over there are identical to us. You know, we talk about being family. You know, we talk about being a Native family across the world, because they have the same challenges in communities, from the same trauma and the same dispossession of land, culture, and theft of all the principles that we live by. So a lot of our cultural practices, a lot of our belief systems are very similar. I've sat down with elders right across the country in the US and told the same stories as out here. You know, so a lot of our systems are very, very similar. It's just a different part of the globe. And, you know, a lot of our challenges are the same challenges, you know, high incarceration rates, drug and alcohol challenges.
That's right.
Abuse in communities. Like, it's, you know, it's identical. You know, and my whole train of thought changed when I went from, I did the keynote at the World Indigenous Suicide Prevention Conference. And out of that conference, sort of realized that the conversations around the room was that people weren't dying from mental health. People are dying from colonization, and the trauma that's been impacted in taking away the way that we've lived for thousands and thousands of years.
See, there's that intergenerational trauma, spot on. So you're doing a lot of great work within the community. You obviously have been, and where you're talking about going back to where COVID's hit, which has been a shame. So you're not getting out doing a lot of the good stuff that you're doing. So with a lot of the workshops that you do and have presented, so can people still access them in a different format, say like this, whether it's through Zoom or different mediums, yeah?
Yeah, what we've been doing, we've obviously, you know, we looked at doing things differently, and the world went virtual last year. So, you know, we've done sessions in schools and organisations and corporates and everyone, where it's just Zoom sessions, and we've done one-on-one sessions. We've done lots of different things. You know, so it's just about looking at how we do things differently, you know, and getting the same aspect of how we do it, but just doing it differently. Absolutely. Yeah, we're lucky enough to get impacted, you know, and we're connecting with many different communities right across the world with what we do, you know, not just in Australia as well. So whilst it's been challenging, it's been, you know, technology has been a good thing for us as well.
That's awesome. So it's even broadened it out to other communities in other parts of the globe. That's solid, brother. So enemy within. So with goals going forward. So what's it looking like from 2021 moving forward, mate, and some of the things that you want to establish now the world's gone turned upside down. We're working in different mediums like this through Zoom, and you're doing some workshops that are reaching other people on other parts of the globe. So what are you going to be doing moving forward, and what are some of the goals?
Yeah, what we're doing is we're looking to do things differently again. Like we've developed a three-month program to help with individuals and communities. So what we're doing is working on different things that we can do to help young people with their behaviours, and look at some trauma recovery stuff. So we come up with what we call the TRIC program, Trauma Recovery Identity and Connection, which is all about helping young people to identify the behaviours that they have and then readdress those behaviours And then, you know, work to move them back into school full time and back into family full time, and, you know, working a lot with the youth justice and out of home care systems and those sort of systems as well. So, you know, it's exciting time for us. And, you know, once we did a pilot of this program initially and it went really, really well. So we're going to start to broaden it out a little bit and then hopefully get funded to go across some other communities.
Good on you. Solid, Bella. So if people want to get in contact with you, whether it's, you know, email through the business with their enemy within social media, whatever it may be, throw it out in the atmosphere, Bella.
So my website is www.joewilliams.com.au. My Instagram and Twitter handles are @JoeWilliams_T for Tom, E for egg, W for Williams, JoeWilliams_TEW. And my Facebook page is The Enemy Within, Suicide Prevention, Education and Wellbeing Education.
Well said. Well, hey, I hope, you know, even with all the lockdowns and whatnot, I hope it just opens right up on this platform with Zoom, like you said before. And you keep doing the good work in the communities, whether it's you physically there or you doing it in the digital space. So, and I really want to say thanks a lot for jumping on the show and having a yarn with us and spreading the love, brother. And yeah, you keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, brother. And always a pleasure to connect with mob all across the country. And mate, it's been a real pleasure. We've had a couple of different hiccups with the technical difficulties, but mate, it all worked out well, and I'm really glad that we've been able to connect. So thanks very much.
Beautiful, brother. Appreciate it.
Thanks, brother.
All right. See you, folks. It was a solid yarn chat there with Mr. Joe Williams, and just the importance of suicide prevention and wellbeing education and everything that he covered there. Don't hesitate to reach out to him. Awesome resource. He's doing solid work in all communities around the continent and even tapping in overseas. So reach out to the fella. Enemy Within. Doing solid work, brother. Keep it up. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've got a Patreon page, so if you want to become a part of the squad, hit the link below. That'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram @StreetRollingCheetah or email one word, StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And want to thank our sponsors, Permanville Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. They got great assistive tech also. So righto, see you on the next one.